Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Cocktail Party by T.S. Eliot. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Christina Lambert, a professor of English at Hillsdale College. She joins us in the studio as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Christina, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Thanks so much, John. I'm delighted to be here.
Why is The Cocktail Party by T.S. Eliot a great book?
So I think we should appreciate The Cocktail Party, firstly, on a formal level. So this premiered in 1949, and it's a play operating on two planes. So we get this divine drama, and it's drawing from ancient Greek theater and liturgy. And we also get it in the form of a drawing room drama and a comedy. And it's, for Eliot, the most successful iteration of his dramatic theory. So he's doing all the things that he wanted to do in his dramatic theory, but also it's his most popular play, and it's going to have a great run on Broadway and in the West End. The second reason we could appreciate this book is it has a kind of immediate accessibility that Eliot's poetry doesn't necessarily have, and that's on purpose, but it's engaging in the same kind of conversations. So, for instance, in The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, which you might be familiar with, we have a character who is etherized, so to speak, by his own inaction. He exists outside of human relationships, and he's asking endless questions about his purpose, how to be in relationship. He's a picture of isolation, anxiety, indecision. The Wasteland gives us people who we could call unreal. They're undernourished spiritually and physically, and they can't even respond to the violence committed against them. So it seems like even justice fails in this desert. They don't produce life, they take it away, and it's a famously infertile land, and the relationships are famously infertile. So we can read The Cocktail Party as telling a story about characters suffering from these kinds of afflictions and learning how to become real again. And so ultimately, it's a depiction of the tough and real road of sanctification. And I think that we see Eliot showing us how holiness makes humans more human and capable of meaningful relationships. Russell Kirk has this great line where he says that Eliot gives fresh forms to ancient orthodoxy. And I think in this play, we see Eliot help us reimagine really common themes and terms like sacrifice and hospitality.
We're going to talk about all that, what this play says, who are the characters, what is their story, these themes of sanctification and holiness, the connection to Greek drama from long, long ago, and a lot more. Christina, let's just start with how the play begins. We have about a half dozen characters gathered. They banter. So we start to learn that someone is missing and that there is a stranger among them. What's going on in Act 1, Scene 1 of The Cocktail Party?
Great. So I love Act 1. I think from beginning to end, it's really perfectly crafted. And we start and we're just feeling the realism of the drawing room drama, right? They're chatting, they're bantering. We're not really sure. They're just gossiping about these different threads and stories. It really feels like kind of random conversation at a party. And this is going to be one of the main themes of the play. People talking, chatting, but they're not really communicating, right? And so we have this banter where they're asking the main character, Edward Chamberlain, who's hosting the party, where's your wife? And he's giving them all kinds of stories and lies that he's making up because his wife, we learn, has left him. She's left their marriage. And so even while there's a lot of chatter, there's no real communication. And this is going to be mirrored in this kind of strange, seemingly tangential chatter about the food at the party, which is as absent as one of the hosts, Lavinia, Edward's wife. Everyone keeps saying, you know, the alcohol is freely flowing, but we only have olives. We only have chips, right? This isn't a proper party. And so we realize that what's mirrored in their marriage, Lavinia missing, is also mirrored in the absent food. So there's nothing here to eat. And then building upon this, all the guests keep talking about how hungry Edward is. They say, Edward must be fed. You're looking absolutely famished. And Edward, the host that's there, keeps rejecting these meals, saying, oh, I'm too tired to go out. I'm not hungry at all. I'll just have some biscuits. What we're also beginning to see here that's going to be unraveled in the rest of the play is that Edward has a problem, right? His dissolving marriage. But he's apathetic about it in the same way he doesn't care about eating, right? So I don't want to eat. This is going to model and demonstrate for us Edward's just total apathy about his life. He doesn't even want to feed himself. It moves on to this strange moment where this character, Alex, is really determined to make Edward a meal, which feels really random, right? And as Alex is going into Edward's pantry, he says, I've never seen so few ingredients, right? Never, even while traveling, have I seen so few ingredients in order to make a meal. And once again, we're being set up for the fact that there's so few ingredients here, thinking of love, humility, whatever it would take for Edward's marriage. There's so few ingredients for his marriage, as echoed in his empty kitchen. Alex can hardly make a meal for him.
So lots of metaphors.
Exactly.
Already. There's a curious figure on stage right at the beginning, throughout the play, but right at the beginning when you meet him, he's called the unidentified guest. We don't even have a name for this character, at least not yet. Who is this person?
Yeah, so the unidentified guest we're going to learn later in Act Two is this kind of enchanting figure, Sir Henry Harcourt Riley. And there's an Eliot scholar, Tony Kuda, and he calls him part psychologist, part priest, part music hall comedian, right? He's all of these figures meshed into one. But we meet him first as an unidentified guest. And he's going to say to Edward, right, like, I am the stranger. He's going to say it right out to us. And I think this begins the thread of hospitality that, right, I mean, first in the absent food, but this idea that there's someone here that hasn't been invited to the party. And the first good move maybe that Edward makes isn't to kick him out because he doesn't see him on the invite list, but to offer him a drink. And by extending hospitality to this stranger, he begins really the healing events of the play just by welcoming him and saying, all right, you know, do you want a glass of gin, right? And so we start seeing the unidentified guest as one of the first of these semi-angelic figures in the play. And I really do think that Eliot is working off of Hebrews 13:2 here. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. And we have kind of this angelic figure that gets welcomed into the drama by Edward offering him a drink here.
The scene takes place in a London drawing room. What is a drawing room? I don't know that I have one in my house. So first of all, what is a drawing room? And then there is this genre of theater called the drawing room comedy. Is this one of those?
Yeah. So, and this is thinking about the two levels this play is operating on. The first one is just a drawing room drama. So this is going to be a type of play developed during the Victorian period. It's going to be really familiar to British audiences. And think of the drawing room as the central space in the home. It's your living room. It's where you'd entertain. It's where you'd have people into your house. But this is really squarely situating the play for Eliot's London audiences, right? And so he's trying to say, hey, this is a genre you're familiar with. They're at a cocktail party, which is something you're familiar with. Everything here, from the banter to the relationships to the setting, is going to be something that's comfortable and accessible to you. And then the play is going to be interrupted by these strange angelic figures that we're not going to feel as comfortable with. And that's where the drawing room drama aspect kind of falls apart or breaks a little bit.
The drawing room comedy is often called, is this a comedy? Is the cocktail party funny?
Well, that depends on whom you ask. And I think that if you were to see it performed, I wonder how many more of these jokes would come off depending on the actors. Originally, this unidentified guest in the 1950 performance is played by Rex Harrison, a familiar and famous name at the time. And so I can imagine these jokes maybe coming off a little funnier in a performance. But I think the more important level on which this is a comedy is thinking of Eliot loves Dante. He loves the Divine Comedy. It's a work he works with throughout his entire life. And thinking about this movement, right, from misery to happiness, a movement toward joy, a movement towards God. And how can we see the play, once again, operating on two levels? As it's funny, it's entertaining. Eliot wanted it to be entertaining, but also he wants us to see this movement toward God of his characters.
Dante's Divine Comedy, of course, famously unfunny.
Exactly.
So the comedy is kind of technical term in certain ways. It does begin with a sort of lightness, as you suggest, and the audience might be seducted into thinking this is going to be a comedy full of banter, and then it gets a lot heavier.
Right.
Now, question then about T.S. Eliot and what he's doing writing plays at all. I think of T.S. Eliot as a poet. I think that's how most people, when they think of T.S. Eliot, they think of him as a poet. And if they think of his other writings, they might think of him as an essayist. They don't always think of T.S. Eliot as a playwright. And yet he wrote a number of plays. There's not only this one, but there's another one for which he's well known called Murder in the Cathedral, which is prior to this one. This was written in 1948 and then performed and published subsequently. Murder in the Cathedral from 1935. But introduce us to this idea of T.S. Eliot as a playwright, which is a little bit, at least, unexpected.
Yeah. So I think this is another layer of Eliot that we've been thinking about right now in Eliot's scholarship. And I think there's a real movement to say, this isn't a new part of Eliot that he picks up later in his career. It's actually a part of the earliest interests of Eliot as a critic and an artist. And so this is going to start with him just kind of messing around and putting on theater productions while he's in Cambridge and at Harvard. It's going to move into when he lives in London and he wants to attend performances. He reviews theater productions. He's very invested in the life of theater, in ballet, in the arts, in comedy hall musicians. And so from very early on in his career, he has this interest in what theater as a genre can do that other things like poetry can't. And so one of the things that's really intrinsic to his dramatic theory from the 1920s till the end of his life is going to be this participatory element and the idea that it's popular and audiences can engage in it. So he writes this beautiful essay about Murray Lloyd, who's a famous comedy hall singer, and he says that she's a real model for engagement at the time, and she's just, you know, singing songs and singing to popular audiences. And he says she has a real sympathy for her audiences and they engage with what she's doing. And I think in Eliot's mind is if we want to transform hearts and minds on a large cultural scale, wouldn't you need an art form that's popular and participatory and immediately speaks to audiences? He says that poetry is something that you read again and again and again. I'm teaching an Eliot seminar right now, and my students could attest, you have to read The Wasteland quite a few times to really engage with it. He says, but theater is something that you're supposed to sit down for 2 hours and immediately connect with in this space of performance.
I find The Wasteland a hard poem to read. One of the things you have to do to begin to understand it is try to make sense of his influences, what went into the writing of this poem. And you mentioned earlier that for the plays and the cocktail party, one of Eliot's influence is the Greeks. And he liked Greek drama. It influenced what he did here. Help us understand that connection. Why is he looking to the Greeks? What are they doing? How do we see the influence of the ancient classical Greeks on the cocktail party?
Yes. Yeah, so this is going to bring us to another really core tenet of his dramatic theory. He says that drama always has structure, right? For the ancient Greek drama, they're always wrestling with fate. He says for Elizabethan drama, they're wrestling with, you know, the inevitability of death, and he has some other themes. And he thinks that Greek drama, specifically this ancient form, is going to give a kind of structure to contemporary drama. And once you have a structure, then you can kind of play around within the structure. And so he reads this book by F.M. Cornford called The Origin of Attic Comedy. And this is published in the early 20th century. And it just gives some basic features of what a drama has. And some of the features that Cornford's going to identify is there's always going to be combat or death, feast and sacrifice, and then this is going to lead to rebirth and marriage. And so within that, there's always these masked or stock characters that you're going to see come up. And two of these figures that I think are important for the cocktail party are the figure of the doctor, who, in the words of Cornford, recalls the dead god to life, and then the cook, who's interchangeable with the doctor. I think in the characters of, right, the doctor, Sir Henry Harcourt Riley, and Alex, who cooks up a meal for Edward, we're seeing these type characters of agents who will come in and help move along the ritual and help the character who's the, you know, centerpiece of the transformation taking place. So it's not obvious that Elliot is bringing these characters into the drawing room, but he wants to bring them in because he wants to complete the ritual and have a sense of rebirth by the end of the play.
Let's go back now to the first act of The Cocktail Party. Where we left off, we had Edward Chamberlain, our host, and his missing wife. She's not there. There's an unidentified guest. We later learn he's the psychologist, doctor figure, Riley. There's another character we need to talk about, and that's Celia. Who is she, and what is she doing at the party?
Yeah, so this is another thing that's revealed in the course of this banter, right? Edward's wife, Lavinia, is absent, but the woman who's present, Celia Copplestone, one of the guests, is the woman he's having an affair with. So another piece of Act One is Celia's going to come to Edward and talk about the affair, and this is going to map onto Edward's apathy, right? She's going to say, we had an affair, but I'm not sure if you loved me, and Edward's going to kind of say, I'm not sure if I did love you. She says, I'm not sure even that you seem real enough, right? So as we keep unpacking the character of Edward, we're going to have these moments where Celia is going to identify, I'm not even sure that it matters that this falls apart because I'm not sure how real you are in terms of your, like I said, he's undernourished physically and spiritually, and he's not even real enough to care about his lost marriage or his affair.
Now, while all this is going on, our unidentified guest at one point promises Edward that he's going to return with Lavinia. I'm going to bring back your wife.
Right.
Where does that take us?
Yeah, so the unidentified guest is going to keep pushing on Edward's apathy to reveal this to us. And he says in Act 1, Scene 3, he says, I'm going to bring her back. And he says this line, right? It's a serious matter to bring someone back from the dead. So this maps onto Edward's apathy of saying, you're not an alive person. And so we're not sure if he's going to resurrect Lavinia, as in bring her back, which is going to play upon one of another source text for this play, which is going to be a drama by Euripides, where the god Heracles is going to bring back the man's wife from the dead. But we also feel as if he's going to help bring back Edward, right, from the dead. Riley is going to give Edward some advice for when he brings back Lavinia. And I think that this is a really great moment in the play.
Christine, I know where you're going with this because you're about to read to us, I think, what might be the most famous line in the whole play. What is it, and help us interpret it?
The unidentified guest says to Edward, ah, but we die to each other daily. What we know of other people is only our memory of the moments during which we knew them. And they have changed since then. To pretend that they and we are the same is a useful and most convenient social convention, which must sometimes be broken. We must also remember that at every meeting, we are meeting a stranger.
Okay, so what does that mean?
So I think what the unidentified guest here, who is a stranger, is saying to Edward as a therapeutic, right, for his marriage, this kind of advice for what he should do for his marriage, is saying, practice hospitality in your marriage. Welcome your wife, whom you believe you know, and you know all the problems about her, all her foibles, all her faults. And instead of going in saying, I know everything about you, greet her as if she were a stranger in order to host her and begin to understand her. Pretending we know other people, he says it's a useful convention, right? But if we really want to get to the reality of another person, we must practice hospitality towards them and welcome them and ask them, who are you? Get to know them again. And this is where the strangeness of Elliot comes in. So beautiful to say, treat your spouse as a stranger, and that's how you might begin this conversation and this process of healing.
So it's a little more complicated than just saying, you know, pro tip for your marriage, don't cheat on your wife.
Right.
So then Edward and Lavinia, the husband and wife, come together in the play. What happens?
Yeah, so this is going to be the end of Act One, right? So we begin famished, there's no food, Lavinia is absent, and by the end of Act One, Lavinia is back, and they have this kind of therapeutic remedy, right? Treat each other as strangers. And I think there's a way of reading the scene and being a little disappointed by it. You say, well, they have a fight. How is this a movement towards healing? We're going to see revealed that Edward is really passive. They have a conversation about why they couldn't agree on where to go for their honeymoon because she mentions the city and he says, okay. And she says, all right, that's fine by me too. And they reveal that Edward is passive. Then Edward reveals about Lavinia, well, you never complain, right? And she says, yeah, isn't that a good thing? He says, no, it's not a good thing because I never know what you're thinking. And there's a way of reading this scene where you say, oh, look at them. They're back at it again. But I think what we're seeing is that they're beginning for the first time to have a real conversation with a real person, meeting each other as strangers, and it's amazing that they can now have real communication, right? The fight might actually be a good sign. To draw from some other Eliot in The Wasteland, in this famous scene, A Game of Chess, you have a conversation between a man and a woman who you assume are married, and the wife's lines are in quotation marks, and the man's lines are not in quotation marks, so he's not even speaking back to her. So it's this famous dialogue of a marriage where one person keeps saying, why are you not talking? Why are you not talking? And he's only answering in his mind. So in The Wasteland, we haven't had any discussion or dialogue. At the beginning of the party, we don't have any discussion or dialogue. And by the end of Act One, welcoming each other as strangers, they begin to actually have real communication. Yeah, they're fighting, but they're real to one another. And I think we see this movement at the end of the act when Lavinia says, okay, I ought to go and have a look in the kitchen. I know there are some eggs. We must go out to dinner. There's a movement again towards nourishing themselves, which is going to begin with the empty pantry. And now we're at least seeing them saying, we need to start nourishing ourselves in our marriage.
The play has three acts, not five, like Shakespeare. We move into the second act, and this is where the unidentified guest becomes identified. We learn that he is this doctor, psychologist figure, Riley, and he's a therapist, I guess, right? And he provides counseling to the couple. What happens in Act Two?
Kind of famously, he's a little bit of a therapist, maybe a psychologist. Eliot's going to say about this, it's not so important what kind of doctor he is, but that he is a doctor, because again, he's playing this type character of someone who is going to help with this ritual of rebirth. And I think it's important that Act Two is in a doctor's office, once again, drawing another great theme from Eliot. In Section Four of East Coker, he's going to describe Christ as a wounded surgeon doing surgery on the sick. And so here he's using this medical imagery of saying what kind of surgery needs to take place on the sick characters in this drama. And so everyone's going to have these conversations with Riley. We realize that Edward is obsessed with his own insignificance, and he wants to be sent away to this kind of strange sanatorium that keeps getting referenced. And Riley says, which I think is, this is the part I do think is funny. He says, oh, everyone wants to assign themselves a cure, but I don't think the cure for you, Edward, is being sent away. I think it's going to be in being in relationship with people. You would like to be alone, but how would you heal? In relationship, right? And so we start seeing what the particular cure would be. And even after the movement in Act One, there's still real work of the heart and revelation to take place in this doctor's office with Riley.
He's a pretty aggressive doctor. He kind of tricks them into joint counseling. I'm not sure that's ethical, but that's what he does. And it works, I guess, right? And he persuades them that they're better together than alone.
Right. And so, and I think you're exactly right to say he's unorthodox in his practice, which is maybe as good why he's not specifically identified as in a certain practice. But the way he does this is by revealing these things that they think about each other, right? We learn that Edward is incapable of love and Lavinia is unlovable. And he says, you can use these facts about each other as excuses for understanding each other, saying, look, we perfectly intersect. We're just, or we don't intersect at all because of these mutual failings. Or, and this is where we end up at the end of this act for these characters, at least, they say, we can make the best of a bad job. This isn't a very hopeful depiction of what you can do in a marriage, but I think what Riley's pushing them toward is there will always be excuses for not learning how to love one another. You can accept those excuses and give up, or you can embrace the hard job that you're given. And he gives them a choice to do either one, and they decide to make the best of a bad job.
And before we move on to Act 3 and find out what happens, we have to mention Celia again. She pops up in Act 2. What is she doing here?
Right. So Celia's also going to have this one-on-one appointment, right, with Riley. And if you compare it to his interaction with Edward, there's going to be some real differences here. As Edward wants his own cure, keeps trying to push away any self-knowledge, Celia comes in and she takes blame. She says, I have no one to blame but myself. She says, I find my problem uninteresting, where Edward is obsessed with his own problems and his own cure. And she recognizes this solitude and deep loneliness that she, and she seems as if everyone else in the play also suffers with, this deep loneliness and solitude. And Riley says to her, you suffer from a sense of sin. This is most unusual. She's the character in the play that's going to identify her sin and culpability in this. And that's why we're going to see her just like, you know, a mile further down the road on this path to sanctification, because she can recognize and identify the part she's played in ruining someone else's marriage. And then he gives her a choice, right? He says, you can go live a normal life, you can go wrestle through a marriage like other people, or you can choose this other path, which remains really vague in this section. And she asks, is marriage or this other path better? And this is an important line for the play. He says, for the play, neither way is better, both are necessary. And we're going to find at the end of this act that Celia chooses not the path of marriage and relationship. She's going to choose a different path that's going to be revealed later on. This scene ends with, I think, another beautiful quote from one of these semi-angelic figures. And I think it goes back to where we leave Edward and Lavinia at the end of Act 2. Julia is going to say, all we could do was give them the chance. And now, when they are stripped naked to their souls and can choose whether to put on proper costumes or huddle quickly into new disguises, they have for the first time somewhere to start from. So in this moment, they've been stripped down to their core. They know who each other are. And now they have to make choices. So Celia has a choice at the end of Act 2. Edward and Lavinia have a choice. And then Julia's going to quip, right? Of course, they might just murder each other. Or they're going to choose to participate in this fruitful marriage.
So now let's find out how this play ends. Most of the play actually is Act 1. It's the longest. It's like half the play, I guess. So we move into Act 2. Then Act 3 is short by comparison. But between Act 2... with all these conversations and therapy and so forth. In Act 3, 2 years have passed, and we're at another cocktail party. So, Christina, wrap it up for us. How does this play conclude?
Yeah, so you don't see the ending coming. It's 2 years later. The usually sparse stage directions mention that a caterer's man is arranging a buffet table. I think this is an important detail because there wasn't a proper meal at the first party. And finally, our guests are being fed. So there's something new going on here that we notice from the very beginning. Lavinia asks this caterer's man, she says, is there anything you need that you can't find in the kitchen? And that's a significant question after Alex's escapade in the barren pantry, right? And this character, right, the caterer's man, replies, nothing, madam. And this is important, right? There's nothing missing now. So something has happened and taken place in this household. They're hosting another party. They're willingly welcoming guests. And we have this kind of sweet banter now between Edward and Lavinia. And we've never seen this before. They're making jokes with one another as opposed to at each other's expense. He's complimenting her dress. And we learn indirectly that they're expecting a child. this is a huge moment in Eliot's work. If you've been tracking kind of the plays and poetry up till now, fertility is one of the big problems of the wasteland. It's a barren land, and the people are barren. Here we find out that through this welcoming work, there's a sign of the healing of their marriage. They're welcoming strangers, and they're welcoming a child into their party.
So are they going to live happily ever after in blissful marriage?
I think it's important for us to understand what the work of their marriage will be by the second main event that happens in this strange short third act. So the guests start coming in, and we learn through this conversation that Celia, this figure that chose the other road, right? We learn from the character Alex that she joins a nursing corps, and she goes abroad, and she's been crucified while doing her work very near an anthill, they say, and then her body has been consumed by these ants. Why? Why is this last act interrupted by this strange and gruesome martyrdom, right? I mean, that's what's taking place here. Eliot's interrupting his realistic drawing room drama with a martyrdom in the very end. And I think there's a couple things that are important for us here. Martyrdom is going to be the death in the Christian tradition where you die like Christ and participate in that suffering. Eliot writes a whole play, like you mentioned, Murder in the Cathedral, about Thomas Becket's martyrdom. Here he gives us a contemporary martyr that puts in stark relief the sacrifice of living life in the image of Christ, right? The sacrifices of holiness. But then what Eliot does with this is he puts Edward and Lavinia's sacrifice in comparison and connection to this martyrdom. You'd say, what? They're just working out their marriage. They're hosting a party. Julia announces, the consequence of the Chamberlain's choice is a cocktail party. And Lavinia says, I don't want to see these people. And Riley responds, it is your appointed burden. So their mode of participating in sacrifice is dying to self, loving one another, and hosting a party and welcoming in strangers. And Eliot's showing that sometimes sacrifice looks like martyrdom, participating in the death of Christ in that way, and sometimes it looks like hosting a party and doing the hard work of loving one another.
Christina, you've been using words like martyrdom and angelic, which sound Christian adjacent, shall we say. The play, though, has no reference to Jesus. It doesn't mention God except in exclamations of, oh my God, that sort of thing. Is the play Christian?
I'll just say, yes, it is. And this is a part of Eliot's vision for verse drama. He's saying that poetry operates on two levels, right? Or multiple levels of interpretation, right? You have the words on the page, and then you have interpretation. He writes in verse. This is a metered play with a four-stressed line. And he's trying to say that you can have this story of lives operating, and you're seeing this realistic drawing room drama. And on another sense, we're seeing what it might look like for Christ to break in through these angelic figures, through guests at a party, through a meal, in all these ways that Christ can break into our stories and our lives. And I think it's really important for Eliot that this takes place in a drawing room because he's a part of these agrarian movements, which is another part of Eliot we don't talk about a lot. And they say, wow, cultural renewal will look like going back to the land and the farm, and there's real goodness there. And Eliot shows how we might have cultural renewal through spiritual renewal in a living room at a cocktail party. And he's showing how Christ could break in to those parties in settings that look like our everyday lives. So I think it's important that, yes, it's a Christian play, but that's not immediately obvious because he also wants it to be something, like I said, that people will enjoy and want to attend and then see how renewal might take place through these, the fulfillment of these rituals.
Just a quick question as a teacher, because you teach this play to undergraduates and in your class, I'm sure they read the play. Do you make them watch it? Do you make them see a performance? Is that the right way to understand it, by watching it in addition to reading it?
So I'd love if there were a performance that I could turn them to. I think that you have to think differently about drama, right? You have to read the stage directions and imagine what it means for a meal to be set out. And so to read drama, it really is best to imagine it performatively. And then the best way you could do that would be to see a production. And I think it's a shame that there aren't more productions of The Cocktail Party, because I think we would understand the humor in a different way. We would understand Elliot's vision for participation in a different way. And I think we could imagine the story more richly through performance.
Sounds like a movie that ought to be made. Christina, how did you discover The Cocktail Party? I know you're an admirer of T.S. Eliot, but how did you come upon his plays and this one in particular? What is your experience as a reader?
Yeah, so it took a while for me to pick up the plays, because I think there's this sense of them not being as high of an art form for Eliot, and so we often dismiss them. Kind of famously, Robert Oppenheimer, who we're all talking about right now, he invited Eliot to Princeton in 1948, and he says in the Bird biography, "I invited Eliot here in the hope that he would produce another masterpiece, and all he did here was to work on The Cocktail Party, the worst thing he ever wrote." So there's a lot of shade from the literati, right, about this play. And so I think that people, myself included, focused on the poetry and never really got into the plays. But Eliot's point, I mean, Eliot can write high art. He's the author of one of the most famous poems of the 20th century, the peak of modernist poetics. But he chooses to write plays to meet his audiences in different ways. So it took me a while to get to the play. And when I finally got to it, it was looking for this food imagery for a project I was working on. And I began to realize that Eliot is such a careful poet and dramatist that every detail, from the snacks to the drinks to the angels, is going to be working towards some purpose. And I think in this play, it's sanctification and reimagining hospitality.
So one more question. What's the case for reading the text or seeing a production of it today? Or maybe if you're pitching the idea of The Cocktail Party to a movie producer, why does it make sense to do that in the 2020s? Why does it make sense for us to know this play now?
It's an old story to tell the story of a marriage that either works out or does not. And we produce a lot of art on this topic. I was thinking about Noah Baumbach's A Marriage Story that came out a few years ago. We create art around this drama of human relationships. And this is Eliot's version, and he's going to dramatize how to resurrect a marriage. And I think that we depict this in contemporary art. We're invested in watching what this looks like. This is his version of it. And there's this line from Celia where she says, "Can we only love something created by our own imagination? Are we all in fact unloving and unlovable?" I think the answer to the first question, are we all in fact unloving and unlovable, Eliot would say, yes, we are. And then the first question, can we only love something created by our own imagination? He'd say, no, because if you greet someone as a stranger and make them real, they come out of your imagination, and that's how you might resurrect a marriage. So I think it's a story we're very invested in telling right now, and Eliot has a fresh take and perspective on this story we love telling in contemporary art.
Christina Lambert, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Cocktail Party by T.S. Eliot.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through our website at heymiller.com on Twitter. My handle is @heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.